and we should probably just begin. So I'd like to introduce Karen O'Dea today. Very warm welcome.
Thank you.
Hi. Yay. Hello.
Hey. Hey. Lovely. So Karen O'Dea is a very good friend of mine, and she's a real star for offering to do this talk. And I think that says a lot about Karen O'Dea. She just says yes, probably a little bit too much at times, but she just wants to benefit others. And I think, so her name means she whose wisdom is compassion. Yeah, she's got a, well, when she was ordained, the woman that ordained her preceptor spoke about her, and she said, Karen O'Dea embodies these very two positive sides of her conditioning. So she's she has Indian conditioning, so she's half Indian. So she's got that really kind of bright, happy, positive energy, which we all benefit from. And she's also got her English conditioning as well. And a very naughty sense of humour. Yeah, so she's been ordained 3 years, yeah. And since then has just kind of ploughed tons of energy. Well, not even since then, before then she was as well, but tons of energy into our movement, our Buddhist movement. She's involved with the Young Persons Project, and she takes a study at the Colchester Buddhist Centre and runs days and just keeps saying yes and just gets herself out of the way. That's what she's really good at. So it's a real, real honour to have her here today. Yeah. Karen O'Dea.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Many of you, this is your like natural environment, being in, you know, outdoors, in the field, in nature, and I mean, I sometimes struggle with that. So anyway, we'll see how we get on. So, yeah, I sort of offered to do the talk, didn't massively feel. Just needed to be done. So, I feel really grateful to be talking about the Buddha. Actually, it's something that's very, very close to my heart, and I've been thinking about it for some time. And I'm hoping that I'll be able to communicate what I want to try and communicate. So, what I am trying to communicate actually is how my connection to the Buddha has grown. So it's sort of a bit personal in some ways, and might be biased in some ways or whatever, but that's sort of what it is what's sort of really alive for me in this present moment. So so the title, if there was one, I haven't quite got a title, but I think everything needs a title. So it's a little bit focusing on the theme of the retreat, which is the force of good in the world. So I just thought, what greater thing to be talking about than the Buddha when one is thinking about a force of good in the world? And I hope that that will become clearer as I go on, because some of us might have a connection to the Buddha, or you might not. You might think, how relevant is someone who was around 2,500 years ago? You know, what's that to do with me? So hopefully I might be able to communicate what that's to do with me anyway. So I hope everyone can hear me. Yes? Yes? Okay. So it's very dangerous starting with a poem, but I'm going to do that nonetheless. Yeah? So I'll read it twice, and some of you might know the poem. It's by Kenneth White, called Walking the Coast. But it's just a very beautiful poem, and hopefully it will unfold. So it goes like this. Knowing now that the life at which I aim is a circumference, continually expanding, rather than an exclusive center of pure self. Feeling the whole I seek is center plus circumference. And now the struggle at the center is over. The circumference beckons from everywhere. So just read that once again. Knowing now that the life at which I aim is a circumference, continually expanding, rather than an exclusive center of pure self. Feeling the whole I seek is center plus circumference. And now the struggle at the center is over. The circumference beckons from everywhere. So the struggle at my centre is not over. So it's just something about, I wouldn't actually even be able to understand this poem or what this poem is pointing to without having come across Buddhism, and in many ways without having come across Sangharakshita's elucidation of it. So I often feel that Sangharakshita is sort of the bridge between myself and the Buddha. So it's something about when I first came across the centre, I was about 23, 24, about that age. And I think I was sort of all right, but I was quite deeply lost at the time. In some ways, I was quite deeply lost. And I was really searching for something. And it's very hard to now look back, but I think in a way I do have a glimpse of what my life was like before sort of the Buddha was sort of in it, or the mystery of the Buddha was in it, if that makes sense. So I have a vision of a bit of what I was like and where I was heading, and then came across the centre and people's hard work and what have you, and there was this sort of turning about. Okay, so I must say, many people might feel a connection to the Buddha or have a sense of the Buddha or feel a connection to Buddha figures, rupas. So we've got lovely earth touching one here. There's one behind you. Looks like it's sort of saying hello. But it's communicating something else as well.
Hi. Thank you for your leader.
But for myself, actually, the connection with the Buddha really just crept up on me. So actually, if you don't feel any connection, that's fine. It's sort of taken me years. And I think what culminated in sort of the gratitude that I really feel now is when I was on my ordination retreat 3 years ago, having the chance to be on retreat for 3 months, actually just embody more of a lifestyle, sort of getting up, meditating, you know, eating, working, meditating, sort of eating, working, meditating, just having that chance in a way to more imaginatively lead a simpler life, a bit that what we have a chance to do here in many ways, what we are doing here in many ways, but over a longer period of time, I think I was just really able to see the sense that it made. It just all added up, you know. So I just feel really, really grateful for that. So when you're trying to think about a person or a being, we can sometimes, Vishwapani in his book, which I really would recommend, Gotama and the Buddha, you can sort of track the being by the footprints or the reverberations that the being leaves behind. So we had a joke this morning about a lion, the lion in Essex or whatever. There was no lion, so there were no footprints, so to speak. But anyway, you can see sort of the connection of the Buddha or the reverberations that over 2,500 years on, we're sitting in a field, and this in a way wouldn't be possible without what the Buddha did. So when we're talking about a force of good in the world, actually we wouldn't be here in this form, or some of us wouldn't be here in this form, and if we were, probably be doing something quite radically different here on this field. So when I thought about the Buddha, in many ways I thought, well, there was this guy 2,500 years on, we've got the teachings now, that's what we need to sort of crack on. But I think there's a little bit more to it than that, and I just want to share, as I said, a bit of how my own connection has grown. And one way in which, sort of like more and more recently, I've just had more a sense of Siddhartha. So Siddhartha sort of went on his quest and became the Buddha. So some of us might know this, some of us might not know this. And there was something that sort of set him on his quest. And I just wanted to read a version of that, because I could just really, really relate to it. So some of you might be familiar with the Atthadanda Sutta. But so the Buddha, quite early on in his experience, when he actually looked at his experience, this is what he saw. So he wasn't the Buddha then, he became the Buddha. So this is what Siddhartha saw. So it's like Siddhartha the man. And maybe in many ways this is what we see, or some of us might see to some extent almost on a daily basis, or to some extent at least once a week or something like that.
Can you speak up?
Yes. Okay. Everyone still with me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, so this is what he related. So he said, "Just see how many people fight. I'll tell you about the dreadful fear that caused me to shake all over. Seeing creatures flopping around like fish in water too shallow, so hostile to one another. Seeing this, I became afraid. This world completely lacks essence. It trembles in all directions. I longed to find myself a place unscathed, but I could not see it." So in many ways, that is actually my experience. So that's why I was feeling like I can really relate to Siddhartha the man before he went on his quest. And I think some of the difference is that when I really see that, the desire is just to turn away. And in some ways, actually a friend of mine passed away 2 months ago. And you know, people do pass away and whatnot, but sometimes like the circumstances of it are a little bit more complex and it just doesn't add up. Do you know what I mean? So I think I was sitting with this experience and I was thinking, like, it just doesn't quite add up. Like, what goes on doesn't add up. And for light relief, actually, my flatmate Anne Lacater was away. I thought, oh, I'll just watch this film to, like, just escape it all. Anyway, it turned out to be a film on human trafficking, actually. as it would be. I just thought it was going to be, like, action. You know, like, anyway, it was action, but actually, as the film went on, I was just more and more traumatized by what was going on. And actually, it was really funny, so I was there just thinking, actually, this is real, isn't it? This is real. This is not my world or my experience, but actually, I have worked with people, and I do know that this goes on, and this is real. And actually, the desire was just a deep sense of utter hopelessness. Like, this is the state of mankind, this is what we do to each other, and a real desire to turn away, actually, from that. And interestingly, you know, that wasn't Siddhartha's experience, so we might think that things were really, really different then in going back 2,500 years ago, but actually I think in many ways the age-old root of the problem is with us just as much as it was today. Just as much as it was yesterday, as it is today, and sort of like the root of the problem, in a way, is this sort of hostility, this sort of divide between ourselves and others. So, what I really love about this Atadanda Sutta, about Siddhartha's actually experience, is the way that we do flop around, and in a way, when we are afraid, we turn to things that are incredibly unhelpful. And the main thing is that we turn away. So the simplicity of this is that we hurt each other, and the basic cause of it is it's just driven by our desires, driven by our unhelpful desires. And I don't know if any, I sort of, on a lesser sort of version of it, I don't know if anyone, so all of this is a tiny bit embarrassing, but anyway, so you know, you sort of set your heart on a course of action, you think, right, this is what I'm doing, yeah? And then even in the course of one meditation, something else slowly comes in, and then you think, ah, that seems like a really good idea, and you sort of have a discussion with yourself and think, no, that isn't a good idea at all. But so I think often this happens in relationships, doesn't it, actually? You just think, no, this isn't a good idea, this is sort of what I'm doing with my life. And then something else comes in, and then all of a sudden you're back to just driven by more, sort of, it's described, the Buddha describes it as sort of our veils of passion and veils of wrong view. So, I guess what I'm describing is that there's this subtle turning about. So an experience comes in and there's this subtle turning about, often not always in the most helpful direction. So anyway, the Siddhartha saw this. I think his family name's Gautama, so sometimes I interchange them. So he sort of saw what we do to each other and what we do to ourselves being the root of our fundamental problem. And he decides to go on a quest. So in some ways, we are all on our own individual quest being here today. So I'm hoping that in some ways, through sharing some of these reflections, I'm also evoking the sense of Siddhartha, of the man. So Siddhartha goes on this quest, and he describes it as the noble quest. And this is what he says. "So there is a case where a person himself, being subject to birth, seeing the drawbacks of birth, seeks the unborn, unexcelled, rest from yoke, unbinding. Himself or herself being subject to aging, illness, death, sorrow, defilement. Seeing the drawbacks of aging, illness, death, sorrow, defilement. Seeks the ageless, the deathless, the sorrowless, the undefiled. Unexcelled, rest from yoke. Unbinding. This is the noble quest. So in a way, sort of came across difficulty. So he leaves his home. And in a way, his quest of leaving his home is, he says, I leave my home, I leave my world to save my world. So when we're talking about a force of good in the world, he has this vision of, in a way, what is possible, that there's a greater truth to encounter, that there's a greater quest to be on than the quest of sort of trying to shore up our own existence. Yeah, sort of make things okay for ourselves, you know, and just our loved ones in a limited sort of way. So he goes on this quest, and there's a really beautiful, I don't know if anyone you might, or I'd encourage you to read by Sangha, actually, a very small book called The Buddha's Victory. And in that, he sort of describes some of the victories that Siddhartha overcomes in order for this deep, radical turning about, and it's sometimes described as turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness, to take place. And a few of these sort of victories are, in a way, he goes forth from the group, he goes forth from a way of defining himself, he goes forth to really find himself. And in some ways, we've gone forth for this weekend, for this week, because I know some people have been really helping and have helped set this up for us to enter this Buddha field to a greater extent. So we've all gone forth from a way in which we might define ourselves, what we might be doing on a Friday morning or something like that. So he goes forth, and there's quite a few. I think there's about five victories that Sangharaktika Bhante pulls out. So he goes forth, and he also overcomes spiritual ambition. He also overcomes pride. So there's quite a few victories, in a way, that just being on a field here, just working together, we'll come up against. And there's a real opportunity to just soften and turn towards. So turning towards whatever we encounter is a bit what the Buddha embodies. So anyway, speeding through, because I'm not necessarily going to say the whole of Siddhartha's quest, but needless to say, it sort of culminates in him sitting underneath a Bodhi tree. So it's just like a very ancient or old, beautiful tree. And in a field like this, we might have already found ourselves finding the need for some solitude, or the need to just really go more deeply into our experience, maybe under a beautiful tree here. So he decides to sit under this tree, and he also just decides that he makes this resolve that he's not going to stop meditating until he's uncovered the mystery, until he's awakened, actually. So I just sort of want to describe, just read a bit of a description of this awakening. And if people are interested in play tonight, then there's going to be the enactment of so when you set yourself on a course of doing something, on a course of being skillful and really trying to change deep set habits, you're often met by something, you know. And in a way, I'm going to go on to say why the Buddha is important, why we just don't just need his teachings in terms of how we need to work with our deeper energies that sort of come up when we've set ourselves, when we've sort of really felt that we've seen the truth, and then sideways this Arctic truck or something more subtle comes and sort of veers us off course. I hope this does relate to some people, and it's not just me, my crazy experience. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they're thinking, yeah, I have that too. Okay. So this is a bit of a description. So basically, Siddhartha sits underneath this Bodhi tree, sort of committed, resolute, that he's not going to move from the spot until he has achieved his goal. And in a way, it's very hard to imagine what that resolve must feel like, and how that resolve must be deeply tied into the desire to do it for each other. Do you see what I mean? That's what I just think. Wow, what must that be like to have that that resolve and how must it just link into just seeing one's connections with others, and it sort of unfolds. So it sort of says, surrounding him on all sides are thousands of fearsome fire-breathing demons and deformed figures. So it's a bit like something comes to meet us. And this is symbolic of the difficulties every individual will encounter on their struggle towards awakening in a greater or smaller extent. And this temptation represents our fears, doubts, and desires to return to worldly pursuits and pleasures. So as he calmed his mind, as he sat beneath the tree, concentration deepened. His wisdom grew bright. In this clear and peaceful state of mind, he began to examine the nature of life. What is the cause of suffering, he asked himself, and what is the path to everlasting joy? In his mind's eye, he looked far beyond his own country, far beyond his own world. Soon the sun, planets, the stars out in space, and the distant galaxies of the universe all appeared in his meditation. He saw how everything from the smallest speck of dust to the largest star was linked together in a constantly changing pattern, growing, decaying, and growing again. Everything was related. Nothing happened without a cause. And every cause had an effect on everything else. This teaching is called conditionality. This itself is an expression of an experience that goes beyond the ordinary world. An experience of directly knowing and touching the ultimate truth and reality of things. So often enlightenment is described as waking up to the truth of things, and it's described in terms of knowledge and vision. And I found this quote actually that I've sort of changed a little bit, but it's this deep turning about. In some ways it can just be easy to imagine that Siddhartha, this man that I can really relate to, whose struggles I just see in my own life on a daily basis. In many ways, I can see, and then he saw there's this radical sort of turning about, this sort of beautiful force of good in the world that comes about. So the Buddha has given us practices, this truth of conditionality. This is his experience, and the practice has really come about through meditation, ethics, and therefore culmination of wisdom through these practices. But the Buddha offers practices that opens us up, opens up the mystery of the human heart and the deepest realities that exist in our human heart, uniquely in us, right here and right now. And the human heart is not personal. The more we fathom our own hearts, the more we find in there the beings of others, and beyond that, the very heart of the world itself. So in a way, it's a bit, it's very hard for me to even maybe try and put into words what enlightenment is, or what the Buddha was really able to, the experience that he came into. All I can sort of say is reading the scriptures that the first person who encountered the Buddha after his enlightenment was trying to define him. He could see that there was something radically different about this being. And he sort of said, what are you? He was saying, are you a god? And the Buddha said, no, the ways in which you could know me have been abandoned by me. So it's hard to just imagine a way of being where there are no reference points, where you're just not defined by your usual way of doing something. You sort of break into a greater degree of creativity. And I'm not really fully going to be able to explain that, but what I can explain is maybe one deep turning about of my own. So before my ordination, I worked quite strongly with my confidence, and what would happen, again this is a bit embarrassing to share, but anyway, what would happen would be, I'd be like going along and I'd be fine, I'd be like, you know, like the sun's shining, the world's looking good, and then all of a sudden I just hit this something, and I wouldn't always know exactly what it was, and I just feel like I was a bit of a worm. Do you see what I mean? It'd feel very visceral, it'd just feel like something really, just like my confidence would go, I can't find a way of fully... And I actually just thought that that would never change, you know, and actually when I was preparing for ordination, trying to really work on myself, a friend of a spiritual friend of mine sort of said, that you really need to work on this. You really need to work on what happens when your confidence goes. What do you turn to when your confidence goes? And it's a bit like I didn't turn to much because I just felt like I dissolved or disappeared in some way. And I remember just thinking, well, I'm never going to be able to change that. It's never going to be different to that, actually. I'm always going to feel like this, but maybe I'll manage it a bit easier. And actually now telling you about it, if it had been like 5 years ago, I'd probably have been upset telling you about it. But actually now it's more of a memory. I'm not saying my confidence doesn't go, but that feeling. So it's a bit like I imagine on a far greater extent the ways in which our reactivity comes about, or the ways in which we define ourselves. It's just that sense of total spontaneity. And nirvana or awakening has been described as this sort of supreme bliss. So in small ways, fundamental change is possible. And on a greater scale, there's a radical turning about that Siddhartha no longer, in a way, was the Buddha. There was this different being who came into being. And there's a path of training which has been, in a way, set out for us, if we'd like to follow it. So I just had a quote from Sangharakshita Bhante, some of our teacher here who's founded this movement, where he sort of says, and this is breaking through into Buddhahood, it's a very, very beautiful seminar, and it's on Free Buddhist Audio if you want to have a look at it. He says, often enlightenment, as I've said, is described as awakening to the truth of things, described in terms of knowledge and vision of reality, seeing things as they really are, not as they appear, seeing things in their truth, seeing things free from any veils, free from any obscurations, seeing them without being influenced or affected by our own assumptions, our own psychological conditioning. So it's a bit amazing even just to imagine what that would feel like, to be beyond our conditioning, to be utterly free, and in a way to feel utterly and deeply connected so that there's no longer you guys out there and me sitting here, but just a very natural flow of things. In a way, only way one can describe it is a sort of state of love, I guess. But he goes on to say, the Buddha actually isn't a personal name. It's not like Siddhartha or Kurandi or something like that. It's a title, and it means one who knows, one who understands. It means one who has realized the truth, who has realized reality. So it says here, so the Buddha, the one who has awoken to the truth, exists in a way outside of time and space, in this dimension of eternity. So it's a bit like the reality is manifesting all the time. The Buddha describes himself as the gates of the deathless are open. So the Buddha is an enlightened being. The form is human. There is a human form, but there isn't the ordinary conditioned human mind. So what I was thinking was, I was on this retreat, and there was this fly that had come in, not your normal everyday small fly, but, you know, sort of quite a big one that buzzes around and bangs on everything. And I was sitting there and I was thinking, it come through the window. I could feel the draft of the window, but it seemed like it was struggling to find its way back out. And the more I sort of tried to help this fly find its way back out, just like the more problematic it was. I don't know if you've ever had this experience of trying to help a creature leave, and it's just never going to happen. And as I was sitting there, I thought, my God, I'm like this fly, you know. So in a way, the gates of the deathless, like reality, how things really are, is sort of permeating. It's constantly blowing through our being. The window is open. The Buddha has opened this window. Yet I'm like this fly, buzzing around, making a lot of noise, or talking quietly, as the case might be, and just banging my head on every item that I can find, even though there's this like breeze of freedom and love and connection. I'm sort of lost in the mire of it. And even though it's almost like the influence of the Buddha is still here and now manifesting, you know, sort of butting my head and try as much as people might help me. You know, it's very hard to find the very entrance in a way that one has come into some extent. So So for myself, the connection with the Buddha has just been very, very historical. But the more I've just been reflecting on the Buddha, the more it's just a bit like it's out of time and space. And in my own practice, so I hope this is helpful, in my own practice, I was just thinking, I've been trying to, I hope this comes down to, I don't know, cliched or something, but I'm more and more trying to have a space in my heart for the Buddha. And if I have this space in my heart for the truth, or more like the way things are, I can just align myself more and more straightforwardly with what I'm really trying to move towards, what I really, really want to achieve. So it's not just this figure 2,500 years ago. Actually, our imagination, we're in the influence of him here and now. And actually, sometimes when I just think, oh, actually, in material form, perhaps, the Buddha isn't here and now, sometimes I can just feel, I can sort of touch a degree of sadness or something like that. But actually, reality is manifesting itself, and in some sort of funny ways, the Buddha's still here because we're still listening to his teachings, and if we're listening to his teachings, he's still communicating to us, if that makes some sense. So there is still this communication, and the more personal we can make it in a way, the more we can evoke our imagination, the more we don't limit the ceiling of what we can be. So it's not me here who could just be that bit kinder, that bit more, I don't know, less reactive or something. Because in some ways, Bhante says that's just our egotism writ large. All I need to do is practice a little bit more, try and glow a little bit more, influence you guys, and, you know, all's right in the world. Actually, there's something bigger that needs to be done, something a lot bigger that needs to be done, that has actually already been done, and all we need to do, in a way, is follow in those footsteps as, well, I would probably say as faithfully as we can. As faithfully as we can, something like that. Okay. So, coming near an end to... Everyone still with me?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of making sense. If not, you have the group. Thank God. Thank goodness. Okay. So it's a bit like awakening is woven into the very fabric of things. It's just woven into the very fabric of things. So why do we still need the Buddha? I've been puzzling over this. When we have his teachings, maybe we could just meditate. Well, there's something about, it's something about this inner and outer connection, actually. So this inner transformation sort of needs to take place. But if it is just us being that little bit kinder, that little bit more ethical, that little bit more mindful, I think we can really limit... really limit what we can be. So actually we need to be able to look outside of ourselves and to have in a way a figure, or to be interested in someone's life story. And just to give you maybe a little bit more of a sense of how revolutionary the Buddha was, because it's very hard to get that sense nowadays when you hear the teaching of conditionality. Things arise based on conditions. So my states of mind, whether they're full of faith and love and serenity, are also based on what I've been up to and what I've been doing and how hard I've been practicing, in a way. So when we hear things are based on conditions, it can just sound, in a way, a bit, little bit mundane. But actually the effect of the Buddha, so there's this story of Angulimala, which some of you may or may not know, but there was a story of this sort of come murderer, come finger thief. So he sort of cut off people's fingers, given half the chance, and had this garland of... So Anguli means finger, I think, in Hindi, if I'm spitting, and Mala is necklace, so he had this garland of necklace of fingers, and he needed just one more. And making contact with the Buddha, the actual effect of the Buddha upon this guy who'd apparently cut off nearly, 99 little fingers of people. So obviously his states of mind, you can imagine, weren't very uplifted or something like that. Making contact with the Buddha, he actually became enlightened. There was a deep turning about. And there are many, many tales of the effect that the Buddha had on people. Another one was, you know, talking about grief and working through grief. A mother who'd lost her child and was actually grief-stricken, absolutely out of her mind with grief. In modern-day psychiatry, we'd call that a severe grief reaction. And actually making contact with the Buddha was able to sort of communicate. And she gained awakening as well and was able to sort of put down that burden of grief. So in many ways, contact with the Buddha would be revolutionary. So I just really encourage you over the course of this day in particular to, if you can, have a sense of if there's any qualities of the Buddha that resonate with you, to hold them in your heart as you go along through your day and see what effect that has on you. So for the point of trying to also make contact with the Buddha is, when we make contact with the Buddha, when we make contact with the sense of potentiality, we make contact with the potentiality that we have within our own self. And that can have a real harmonizing effect and help integrate really deeper energies. So often we think we have to give things up, you know, well actually, how can I be a better person? Well, I need to give this up and give that up and do this more and meditate for longer. And in many ways, if those things looked more and more beautiful, you just naturally do them. You just very naturally do them. It wouldn't be the sense of you were giving something up in order to do that. If you saw them really clearly, you would just think, well, that's the only thing that really makes sense. You know, so why am I doing that? This is what really makes sense. And also the fourth of why we need to do that in the world is that we all have our own precious jewel within us that can glow and be shared. And as we come together, we are still under the influence of the Buddha in this Buddha field. So in a way, the Buddha, if we allow it to, could just communicate directly to us, maybe even what we need to know. So, through connecting with the Buddha, these different qualities we might be able to evoke or water, these seeds we might be able to water within ourselves. Different facets of a jewel, these different seeds of wisdom, compassion, peace, freedom, energy. And this will bring within us just a deeper connection with the different facets, the different currents within our own being. And through this, we ourselves will be able to transform major streams within our own psyche. Okay, so I'm just going to end on a quote from Bhante, and this is in Crossing the Stream. So he says, when the circumference of our lives, so this relates back a bit to the poem, when the circumference of our life stand in correct relation to its center, when the traditional hierarchy of values is restored, and enlightenment once more recognized as the crown and consummation of human endeavor, will things fall together again instead of apart, and peace and harmony reign in the outer even as in the inner life of mankind. So that's it, folks. No small order. Thank you.
Very much, Tamanadu.